Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of July 26, 2018. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Doing well. How are you doing?
Good. And we're also pleased to be joined by Eugenia Gibbons, who is the Clean Energy Program Director at the Massachusetts Energy Consumers Alliance, which is a nonprofit dedicated to protecting consumers and the environment. So, Eugenia, welcome very much, and thank you for coming on with us.
Thank you very much, Ted. I'm happy to be on.
That's great.
I apologize. There might have been a little vibrate there, but we are all set. I'm looking forward to having a conversation with you and DR tonight.
So there's lots going, even though it's the middle of summer, there's lots going on Beacon Hill. And there, in particular, there is a clean energy bill, a bill that we have been focused on for the last few weeks that has gone through various legislative mill, I guess, where it's been ground up into hot dogs and about to be spit out the other side. A bill passed the Senate, another bill passed the House. Those two versions of a new energy bill are currently being considered in a committee, which has to make a determination by July 31st, I think, as to what exactly the nature of this marvelous clean energy bill is going to be. But one of the important features of that bill is something called the Renewable Portfolio Standard. And that's a component, basically, the RPS, the Renewable Portfolio Standard, determines how much clean energy we use in the state. It increases by a little bit, a percentage point each year, and the big debate is down in on Beacon Hill is about how much to let that increase each year. Fortunately, someone as smart as Eugenia is on the case and has recently wrote an article in Commonwealth Magazine, which is a great magazine. It's online only now, but you should check it out. A lot of good environmental reporting in it. But Eugenia had an article about the Renewable Portfolio Standard, and that's why we have her on to join us today. So there you go. So let me ask you, Eugenia, did I get anything wrong about the sort of state of play on Beacon Hill? And can you tell me, so that in a way that simplifies it, what the Renewable Portfolio Standard is?
Sure. You didn't get anything wrong, Ted.
Okay.
Thank you very much. And I'm happy to explain to you sort of in a little more detail than what you just provided, what the RPS or the Renewable Portfolio Standard is. So as you noted, the RPS is a minimum percentage of renewable energy that regulated electric distribution companies, so your utility, National Grid, Eversource, okay. Unitil, or competitive suppliers, are required to provide each year.
And they provide those to the state?
They provide to their customers.
Okay.
So our energy, a percentage of our energy mix has to be, a certain amount of it has to come from what's called Class 1 renewable resources.
Mm-hmm.
Class 1 is a term that's often bandied about. All it means is new. New projects that have been in operation since 1998.
Mm-hmm.
And those projects are renewable. They have to be clean. They can be solar, wind, on and offshore, anaerobic digestion, resources that are not going to contribute to our greenhouse gas emissions in Massachusetts or in the region. And the projects have to be in the region. So that means in New England some of the resources can come from New York, as long as they're meeting Massachusetts load.
Mm-hmm.
So the RPS was put into place about two decades ago. And in that time, it's been an essential driver for the development of renewable energy, renewable projects in the region. And those projects have been instrumental in displacing fossil fuel generation. So cleaning up our grid by getting rid of things like oil and coal and some gas too. So they've helped to bring new renewable projects online. And those renewable projects bring with them economic development, job growth. They help to stabilize electricity prices. And so they're, and not to mention all of the public health benefits that come with non-emitting resources. So that's what the RPS is.
And tell me this, you said a word, you said that the RPS drives renewable energy into the system. I mean, how does it drive the development of new renewable projects?
Sure. Well, it sets a requirement that the utilities have to provide a certain amount of their supply from those clean energy projects. And so because that requirement is in place, it sends a signal to the market saying there's going to be this much demand from year to year for these types of projects. And when the electricity is generated through renewable projects, there are two pieces of those projects that have a value. One is the electron that goes on to our grid. And we like that because we're sending clean energy into the system. But there's no way to really track that electron or where it's going, you know, if it's coming from that wind turbine and coming into my house. So one way to track the green quality or value the green attribute of the clean energy is through something called a renewable energy certificate, or a REC. And that REC has a value. The value of the REC is determined, so each megawatt hour of generation, each megawatt of generation results in a REC.
Which is basically a piece of paper that says there is cleanness, there's virtue associated with that megawatt hour that went onto the grid or something, right?
Exactly, exactly. So every time the turbine spins, a REC gets generated, and those certificates have a value. And it's basic economics. The value is set based on supply and demand. And so as long as there is a demand there for that green product, there will be a need to demonstrate compliance with the RPS or to purchase that REC. That's how utilities prove that they're meeting the requirements of the RPS. They purchase the RECs.
And the RECs be made in the new the Class 1 renewable energy projects. So that makes the demand, right?
Right, the Class 1 component, that new component. There's also something called Class 2. Those are just old resources that have been in place since they were in place before 1998. So 1997 or before. But what we're really talking about here, the thing that's really driving demand for renewables and helping to get new projects online is that Class 1 requirement. So I like to say, you know, most regulated entities are not, utilities aren't necessarily going to voluntarily try to get more clean energy into their mix. There's a cost that comes, they would say there's a cost that comes with doing that because, again, they're purchasing the RECs. I would say that there's no cost. The cost there's a cost of a number of costs associated with increasing our reliance on fossil fuels and continuing to purchase fossil fuel generation, but we don't have to have that conversation right now.
The externalities, right?
The externalities, but even the real cost of the fuel. So the beauty of renewables is once they're built, there's no fuel costs, which is why they help to stabilize overall electricity costs, because you're not paying for the fuel itself and there's no volatility that you're exposed to.
Just paying the mortgage on the wind turbine.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. So the utilities often have to be compelled to do some of the things we need them to do most for the environment and for ourselves. And the requirement, the RPS, is a requirement. So they have to comply with it, or they have to pay what's called an alternative compliance payment if they don't meet that requirement. And by increasing it each year, we're saying you have to get more and more renewables online each year. More and more new renewable energy needs to come online each year to help meet that requirement. The reason, going back to the two components, the REC and the electron, the REC, that value helps to both the combination of the consistent signal being sent to the market that we need this resource over an extended period of time, that helps to send a signal to developers. It gives them assurance that there's going to be a need for what they have. And then the REC has a value that helps make those projects financeable. It helps to pay for the project.
Go ahead.
Oh no, so that flight
I was
not
going to
by
ask you
me.
just the utility. So NSTAR has to buy the RECs up to a certain percentage of its power, but they would say NSTAR contract with somebody to put a wind turbine, or does the wind turbine developer, is he independent and just decides that he's going to make money by putting up wind turbines, kind of not independent of the RPS, but he looks at the RPS as the market signal, and he goes ahead and then he shops his RECs around? Is that the way it works?
Well, there are a couple different things that happen. So one thing is I can't just decide to go build a renewable project and then hope to sell my RECs in the market. So the projects that qualify for the RPS are listed and maintained in a database that is maintained by DOER, and the RECs are traded in a regional market.
Okay.
And they're kept in a database maintained by NEPOOL.
Okay.
There are different ways that the combination of the RECs and the electrons can be secured through a contract. So it's possible to buy both the electron and the REC.
Mm-hmm.
And to sign a long-term contract for that, and the renewable portfolio standard, but in setting that standard over time helps someone enter into a longer-term contract.
Right.
But what's not purchased or agreed upon through a long-term contract is sold on what's called the spot market. And so this is getting very into the weeds. I'm sorry,
but the
idea is that there may be a situation where perhaps there's it might be the end of the year,
mm-hmm.
and perhaps more RECs are needed to make sure that compliance is achieved. And so those RECs would be purchased on the spot market.
Right.
Another thing is this, I just want to clarify, because there are a lot of communities, and including a lot of MCAM communities, who do something called municipal aggregation,
mm-hmm.
where they include, or green municipal aggregation, where their community has gone out to purchase electricity supply on their behalf, and they've made a commitment to additional Class 1 resources. That's different than the RPS requirements,
mm-hmm.
but it does the same thing in terms of driving demand for new resources, because regulated entities have to comply with the RPS, but the RPS is only going to drive the development of new resources up until the point where compliance is reached. And so if we really want to push the envelope further, there are two things we can do. We can be in a community, and we should do both. We can be in a community that's saying we want even more renewables than what the RPS says,
mm-hmm.
and that's going to drive demand in one way. And the other way is to increase the RPS and to set that standard higher, and that drives demand in another way. And we honestly need everything we can get, all of the renewables possible, if we're going to meet our climate objectives.
So that, thank you. That explains a lot. I guess the follow-on sort of next topic is so you just said we could increase the RPS, which means we could increase the annual percentage growth, right? And what's happening on Beacon Hill right now with respect to this RPS?
Sure. So there is an energy bill that's being considered and deliberated over right now by a conference committee that consists of 3 members of the Senate and 3 members of the House. And the bills, the conference committee is tasked with trying to reconcile the differences between the House energy bills or bill that passed and the Senate energy bill or bills that passed.
Mm-hmm.
And in both chambers, a bill that would increase the renewable portfolio standard has been passed. In the Senate, that was a 3% per year annual increase. So just to put into context, I just want to help folks kind of understand this. Right now in 2018, the RPS requirement is 13% renewable Class 1. So that means 13% of our supply will come from wind or solar anaerobic digestion.
Okay.
Next year, that's under current law, that will be 14%. And then what it'll increase 1% per year indefinitely. The Senate bill says we need to increase 3% per year. So we would go from 13% to 16, 16 to 19, so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And then the House version of the bill works its way to a 2% per year increase, beginning, I believe, in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a little bit more modest increase than what the Senate has proposed. And the challenge before the conference committee right now is in trying to decide how to reach a compromise and what would work best for Massachusetts. I will say that analysis, and we speak about this in the Commonwealth piece a little bit, analysis has shown that the greatest benefit to Massachusetts in terms of job growth, economic development, stabilization of electricity prices, diversification of our overall electricity supply, all of these benefits mm-hmm. come with an increase. Right. We see more of those benefits with a 3% per year increase.
Right. So we want the joint committee to go with the 3% RPS because that has the most benefits for the state.
Right.
And
right.
Excellent. So now, after this wonderful introduction, I guess tell me about the article that you had in Commonwealth Magazine, and I think it was, just briefly to set it up, I think that you were making kind of a refutation of arguments that said that the RPS was not a good idea, and that the Senate should not have a high annual increase rate. Is that fair? And tell me what do the bad guys say about RPS that we need to make sure are beat down, so to speak.
Sure. Well, I don't know if they're the bad guys, but they're definitely the opponents to the good thing here.
Okay, that's a very nice way. You're very politic.
By and large, there's broad support for an increase in the Massachusetts RPS.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen big businesses in Massachusetts, important companies in Massachusetts, like Legal Seafood, for example, comes to mind. And a number of others, the healthcare sector has come out overwhelmingly in support of an increase in the RPS, the most robust increase that analysis supports, so 3% per year.
Mm-hmm.
The folks who have sort of put up a yield sign and have been pushing this message that we need to move slow or we don't need an RPS increase this year have mostly been the utilities who would be tasked with complying with this. And there are a number of different reasons why they say that's the case. And then there are the reasons that perhaps they're perhaps more motivated by that. Right. I can only speculate to.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And so I co-authored this piece with Deborah Donovan, who is at Acadia Center. And we tried to sort of put to rest and dispel any confusion that's been put out there about the RPS and how it interacts with other key policies in Massachusetts.
Okay.
So very quickly, the opponents to the increase, so the utilities and an entity called Associated Industries of Massachusetts, or AIM, have said a couple of different things as they oppose the RPS. One is that that the RPS is somehow incompatible with these long-term contracts or large-scale hydro procurements that were part of the 2016 energy bill that passed.
Right,
so Massachusetts
right.
is required to go out to bid for both electricity, for hydroelectricity and for offshore wind.
And that was the big debacle where they tried to put the Northern Pass power lines to New Hampshire, right? And New Hampshire rejected it.
Right. That was one of the hydro projects. Exactly. Right. So what the opponents have said is, hey, you know, clean energy is great and we need it, but you already have all of these requirements in place in terms of hydro and offshore wind and the RPS. And so it doesn't make sense to try to make us do more RPS eligible resources because that will somehow undermine this infusion of hydroelectricity that we have coming down the line.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they've explained that is to say, hey, Massachusetts, you also have this thing called the Clean Energy Standard, which is another way to help clean up electricity supply. It's a regulation that says, in addition to the RPS, our electricity supply has to have low or non-emitting resources of a certain percentage.
Okay.
So the thing that's important there is the Clean Energy Standard and the RPS are not the same thing. We need both. The RPS is about those new resources, class one, wind, solar, so on and so forth. The Clean Energy Standard is about hydro, mostly.
Okay. So, all right. They respond to different kinds of requirements.
Right. I mean, they're different policies, but they are complementary policies to each other. They serve different purposes, but they in the end, together, would work well to displace fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. So we tried to make clear that that argument that somehow the RPS and the Clean Energy Standard or the hydro procurements are incompatible with each other is really just sort of a red herring that's put out there by opponents.
And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but if the state used a 3% RPS, we would be at 50% clean energy from the Class 1 RECs, and we'd be getting 20% of our energy from Hydro-Québec, which still leaves 30% that needs to be dealt with. So to your point, there's no great conflict between the hydro, satisfying the hydro electricity requirement and the RPS requirement, right? Is that fair to say?
Exactly. That's exactly fair to say. And it's just, I mean, the math just simply doesn't work out when you try to make the case against an RPS increase. The name of the game and the end game really is in cleaning up our electricity supply and making it as clean as possible, because that's really the best way to achieve deep greenhouse gas emissions reductions. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, there's plenty of room in the market and in our supply for more wind, more solar, and some hydro. And the two are not at odds with each other. And honestly, if we were in a position where the clean energy standard is being met with renewable portfolio, with RPS resources, that's really okay too. Because at the end of the day, the RPS resources are local and in region. Mm-hmm. So we're keeping those dollars in region and in state, and we're supporting the development of renewable projects that are close to home versus directing our dollars towards importing large amounts of hydro. Mm-hmm. Mass Energy, the organization I work for, we do believe that hydro has a place in the decarbonization of our electricity supply. And so we really don't see how we can, and an analysis supports this, it would be hard to reach our long-term climate goals without some hydro. Mm-hmm. But when push comes to shove, the Class 1 resources are really
the
way to go. They're the RPS is really the best tool for the job, and those are the best resources that we can get.
Well, I think that's a great place to leave it. I would say that, dear listener, this RPS question hangs in the balance even as we speak, right? This is late July, July 31st. This joint committee is going to have to resolve the question, and we want them to resolve it in favor of the 3% renewable portfolio standard. So I would urge you to call your representative, your senator, tell her that we want the 3% RPS, and to urge these six people that are huddled halfway between the Senate and the House chambers figuring out what this new bill is going to be. You know, we want them to do the right thing. Right, Eugenia?
We do. That is a good way to end it. And I would say, although they've waited till the last minute, there's plenty of time to make some real great strides on clean energy, and the RPS is sort of is the important starting point. So yes, contact your representative, contact your senator, contact conferees, and urge them to act. They have to act this session. This is very important.
And DR, I'm sure you agree with that assessment, and you would say,
absolutely.
Keep going,
as we like to say, exactly, power concedes nothing without a demand.
That's great. All right, so what we'll do is we'll put up a link to Eugenia's article and to various other things we pulled together around what's going on in the State House. That'll be on the blog at massclimateaction.org/blog. We'll put up a link to the show on our Facebook page. It's at @massclimateaction. You should hang around there. There's all kinds of interesting things going on. You can listen to the show directly on your smartphone using Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Overcast, Podbean, SoundCloud. And, of course, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, the mother of all podcast distribution systems. So we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the reckless policies of the new administration not be accepted as normal, and that the United States put a long-term and equitable price on carbon. So thanks for being here, DR.
Thanks.
And Eugenia, thank you so much for taking the time to come on and chat.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thanks, Ted.
Thanks to
And
everyone.
thank you, DR.
Thanks.
And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.